Hi, I'm Chris Chadwick, Vice President of Healthcare Services here at Mac. Welcome to the next in the series of our video podcast. Today, we're delving into the fascinating field of psychedelic research. If I can remind you that Mac Clinical Research is a global, full-service CRO with science at its core. With a fully owned network of high-performing clinical sites, and many specialist facilities, such as sleep laboratories, a first-in-human MHRA-accredited early phase unit, psychedelic units, GMP manufacturing and pharmacies, as well as state-of-the-art laboratories. So I'm pleased to say that I'm joined today by Dr. Shuna Vincent. He's Mac's Vice President of Clinical Science, who I'm sure will revel in the opportunity to introduce himself and the fascinating role he has at Mac. Shuna, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chris, for that wonderful introduction. A little bit about myself. I've been in the industry for, coming up to 35 years. I've spent most of that time in the pharmaceutical industry, in drug development. I've worked for companies like Sandoz, Novartis, Takeda, and Ono, mainly in CNS research.
Yep.
That's kind of my background. And I spent some time in the CRO industry, looking at CNS global work. And then I joined Mac about 10 years ago as the VP of clinical science at Mac. My role at Mac is really working across all the therapy areas, as well as all the operational people as well. I work very closely with project management, with operations, with the medical staff, et cetera. And I'm really the first point of contact for clients that come to Mac and want guidance, both medical and scientific guidance on their developments.
Fantastic. Interesting you say guidance in that respect.
That's
your
right.
Extensive expertise, obviously, will help them tremendously as that first point of call.
Yeah, guidance, both scientific and medical, is very important for companies doing their developments.
No, thank you very much for that introduction. Right, so jumping into some of the questions that I've prepared earlier on. I just want to ask, what makes psychedelics and their trials particularly unique, and how is Mac prepared to tackle the challenges that they present?
That's a great question. It will probably take hours to answer, but I'll try and condense it down. There's been a resurgence of psychedelics, as we know. People can go on the internet and have a look at that. When I talk about psychedelics, I'm talking about the classical psychedelics, like psilocybin, like MDMA, DMT, LSD, etc. You can throw ketamine into that, but ketamine is more a dissociative kind of a drug as well. So researching these psychedelics are, one, operationally challenging. Two, they require a different format and a way of thinking as well. Now, we've done at Mac coming up to about 14 psychedelic studies. We started off very importantly, being CNS people. That's very important, you know, CNS-driven people. That's my background. That's where the background of the other members of staff are. Infrastructure plays a very important role in psychedelic studies. There's something called set and setting. The set is the mindset, and the setting is where you have the actual dosing. Psychedelics do have a hallucinogenic part to that. You know, people will have an experience. Now, we want that experience in a private environment, etc. You can't have that on the main ward. So our infrastructure allows that to happen. Our EPU that you mentioned has private rooms at the back of the clinic. Those rooms were converted into psychedelic suites. In Liverpool, we have a sleep lab. And being adaptable and flexible, we're pivot. We've converted those rooms into psychedelic suites. And on the first floor, we've converted into a psychedelic area as well.
So can I just say, do you think that investment, not only in the high caliber staff, but that infrastructure is just so important?
The infrastructure is so important, because you want a mindset. The mindset is people coming to the clinic and having that mindset that they're going to experience, they want to be comfortable. The setting is very important as well. You want people coming into the clinic where the setting is calming, comfortable, etc. People experience that in a private setting. That's very important as well. And also what makes psychedelics complicated is you need a whole host of people. You need medical staff, you need raters, you need therapists, you need psychiatrists, etc. And the other thing is, remember, psychedelics are classified as controlled drugs, Schedule 1 drugs. So you need the infrastructure to have those licenses to hold and to possess. And also a lot of our clients ask us to make the psychedelics. So we need to get those licenses. You know, we've invested a lot of money and time in getting the MHRA to come to our unit to actually validate that we have the proper safety procedures when it comes to holding psychedelic. So there is an investment. There is a whole host of people that get involved when you're doing psychedelic research. It's not like your antidepressants where people come in, they have the drug, they go away. That's not what it is about. There is an investment. So not anybody, not any psych can do psychedelics. You know, they've got to have the proper infrastructure and also the people. Somebody comes in, we need to make sure they're the right people. They then get assessed, they go into a private room. And of course, part of the safeguarding is we record their psychedelic offense. You know, we need raters. Now, raters are different to therapists. We need raters because we're rating their kind of efficacy. We need therapists to guide them through both pre, post their experience. And we need psychiatrists because when we do the discharge, we want to make sure they're fit enough to go home. Absolutely. So that requires quite a lot of infrastructure, quite a lot of experienced people, etc. Why? We are CNS driven. That is our backbone, and that's what makes MAC quite interesting when it comes to doing psychedelic research.
Absolutely. No, thank you very much indeed. So I was just going to ask, and you touched upon it there, in what ways does MAC stand out from other clinical research organizations when it comes to CNS and psychedelic studies?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from a CNS background. Most of the staff that I work with are CNS driven. You could include pain in CNS as well. You know, MAC stands for Memory Assessment Clinic, the first one to launch a memory clinic in the UK. Okay, but that's driven because of our love and our passion for neuroscience. You know, whether it's depression, whether it's schizophrenia, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's pain, or whether it's other psychiatric conditions as well. That's what drives us. That's what we've been trained to do. And that's why when we took on the psychedelics, we thought that is an area that we can do. Why? Because the infrastructure allowed it to happen. If somebody wants to run psychedelic studies, it requires a hell of a lot of input and expense to do those type of studies. I think this is where MAC stands out because it's the heritage of CNS that we have.
Absolutely.
Which drives us.
It's just an extension of sort of our core.
Absolutely.
Primary services.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Major depressive disorders is something we've been doing for many, many years. PTSD we've done. You know, treatment-resistant depression is another area. General anxiety, social anxiety disorder. We've all covered those in other areas. So we thought it's the great transition to move them into a psychedelic arena.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So moving on from that, I just wondered if you could tell me how MAC is helping to pave the way for regulatory acceptance as far as psychedelic therapies are concerned. And also, what opportunities does this create for forward-thinking sponsors?
Well, that's a good question. Like I said, there's been a re-emergence or renaissance of psychedelics. You know, there was a counterculture, now it's expected, etc. moving forward. I think from the companies, whether they're biotechs or large companies, or even us, you know, we're pushing the boundaries of psychedelic research. One of the problems we have, I don't know whether it's a problem or not, the regulatory agencies like the FDA, the MHRA, the EMA are catching up. Okay, they're catching up. Only last year, or the early last year, that the FDA put guidance to industries developing psychedelic research. You know, and there are interesting points that pop out from there. So regulatory guidance is complex when it comes to psychedelic studies. They're being revised and reviewed. We, as a company, also look at the guidance that comes out from the MHRA, the FDA in particular, and also the EMEA. The EMEA has recently put a guidance about psychedelic research in Europe. So we got to remain on top of that. So we got to understand, you know, what they want. We got to understand what the endpoints are. We also got to understand, you know, what are the hurdles companies need to go over to get that regulatory acceptance on psychedelic research.
No. Yes, that's so true. So I just want to move on and just talk about, you touched upon after the FDA rejection of Lykos is an NDA phase 3 study in PTSD.
Yeah.
What's the next in the psychedelics pipeline, and what are psychedelic companies saying in this regard?
I think that's another great question. You know, I was actually reviewing and sitting for 4, 5, 6 hours because, you know, the public can attend that. And I was there when the FDA were reviewing the phase 3 data from Lykos. Now, remember, Lykos was an offshoot of MAPS. MAPS stands for the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, which is a non-profit organization. They spun off and made Lykos. Lykos was supposed to be the great hope, where it was the furthest in its development. They submitted an NDA. It was a phase 3 study, like you said, but it was using MDMA or psychedelic-assisted MDMA for PTSD. Yeah. You know, there was a great hope put on that. And having sat through the meeting with the FDA, obviously I was on the web looking at that, you know, they did look at the data very thoroughly. And what was interesting, and again, the way I've been trained, is that you always ask for regulatory guidance. Now, I know MAPS or Lykos did ask for input from the Institute of Clinical Economic Review. They did a review. It wasn't great, and people can look on the internet for that. But MAPS ignored that, or Lykos ignored that. They developed the phase 3 program. They submitted the NDA because they thought they knew what they were doing, etc. And obviously the FDA looked at the data and rejected it. That was last August. And there was a big hoo-ha about that. You know, there was a bit of a tremble through the market of, you know, what happens. But what came out of that was interesting. What was very interesting, the FDA approved drugs and not psychotherapy. That was the big thing. You know, what is the role of psychotherapy? We'll come on to that later on. How to differentiate drug versus psychotherapy? And I think also with regards to the design of the Lykos phase 3 program, there was a lot of intense psychotherapy going on as well. So maybe that contributed, you know, then it's very difficult to differentiate whether the drug's working or that. Safety was another area that the FDA focused on. They also focused on the design. We're going to talk about, you know, subject expectancy and also functional unblinding. That also rolled in as well. So it was a bit naive of Lykos to go to the FDA with an NDA, new drugs kind of application, without taking on board some of the work that was done by the ICER as well. So, and again, that requires a deep dive into why. But those were the kind of key areas. We were surprised they rejected it as well. But I think the most profound kind of view was, how do we differentiate efficacy of a drug with psychotherapy entangled in that? That was a big one as well. How do we manage this blind? You know, because some people will get an experience and some people won't. And these are placebo-controlled studies. You know, what value did psychotherapy have? You know, did it contribute, etc.? Of course it contributed. But then, you know, the FDA were catching up as well. So there have been many waves through the market, let's just say.
And there are a lot of lessons learned as well.
I think that's the big thing. If you look at Compass Pathway with their psilocybin, are very close to their phase 3. So they had to go back and say, right, what did we learn from that? How do we change our design for the phase 3? You know, is there anything we can learn? And that's what they've done. You know, they've pushed back their application. They're redoing some programs, etc. Then you have USONA. USONA is another a drug company that's also understanding what the lessons learned was. You have Cybin as well, are revamping their kind of phase 3 program. You also have other companies like MindBed, etc., things like that. Atai. As well as Beckley, we're kind of reviewing how they should move forward when it comes to the phase 3. Can I just reiterate? It is important that, you know, we take regulatory advice, because at the end of the day, that's the biggest hurdle that companies have. They've got to get over the FDA. The FDA are playing catch up, okay? But you take advice. And you learn from that advice, because
absolutely.
It cost a lot of money to module.
So I just want to ask you then, sort of carrying on from that, if you can tell us, what were the lessons learned in that case from Lykos's rejection?
I think that the key lessons learned was about capturing safety. That's very important.
Yeah.
The key lessons were, you know, psychotherapy. Do we need an intense psychotherapy, you know, before, during, and then follow up? That's another question. very important. How do we manage that functional unblinding or functional kind of unblind that I said earlier? How do we manage the patient's expectancy when it comes to these designs, etc.? And is one dose enough? You know, when is the second dose, etc.? Is the placebo, are you having the placebo the right way to go? Or should we have an active placebo, etc.? All of those lessons are learned. Now, companies are looking at psychotherapy, and we're going to come on to that in a minute. You know, psychotherapy has different forms. It's obviously a very important part. But, you know, there are companies now saying, okay, maybe we shouldn't do intense psychotherapy. Maybe we should have something called dose session monitors. That's another, but it's a kind of a slimmed down version. And other companies saying, well, actually, what we can do is have attendance, where people just hold the hand of the subject and just monitor what's going on while they're influencing and guiding, etc. like that. And there are some companies who are taking the boldest and say, well, we don't need, we'll just give the drug and then we'll see what happens, etc. like that. So that's the lessons learned. From
those real severities of risk in what you've described. Yeah.
I think the FDA will relook at their guidelines, and I think the companies are learning from the Lykos kind of failure and also waiting to see if the FDA do come back with more guidance around that. So really, for me, if you want to summarize it, it's about how you manage the psychotherapy, how you separate that, how you manage functional unblinding, how you manage the expectancy, and how you manage the safety as well. There's abuse liability, and again, we'll touch upon that later on.
No, that's very true. So, Shuna, can I ask you, you've touched upon where MAC is now.
Yeah.
What really are the opportunities in that case moving forward, not only in the UK, but also globally?
That's an excellent question. We did kind of really talk about MAC's experience in the UK and with our infrastructure as well. I think there is a great opportunity to expand and to move, you know, from the UK into America. Okay, a lot of companies are now not just looking at their exploratory first-in-human early phase studies. They now want to do proof of concept studies outside of the UK, both in US and in Europe. I think that's a great opportunity for MAC to explore. We know many psychedelic sites. We've met them. We've seen MAC conference, etc. And that will be the next step, where MAC not only does the early phase, but also does the later phase studies. And we are growing that opportunity, particularly in the US. Europe is a different kind of area as well. There are certain countries in Europe that accept, you know, the psychedelics, but other European countries, there's still a kind of a counterculture around that. So for me, the next step would be to do larger studies, MAC conducting and taking over larger studies in the UK as well as the US, as well as Europe as well. And the way we do that is because, you know, we are a site. We've now moved into a CRO, so we know what is expected of a psychedelic site in the US and also Europe. So we can take that learning to our sponsors and pick the right sites for the psychedelic studies. Why? We've been there. We've done it. We know what a psychedelic site should look like. And we also encounter a lot of our friends in the US that are doing psychedelic studies as well.
And just touching upon that, we know that we've obviously set out our stall out here in relation to everything that we've put in place with our site.
Yeah.
In your experience, are you seeing lots of sites elsewhere that are of the similar standard, so it just will enable that rollout transition to be a lot easier?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is an algorithm that we put together. You know, good CNS sites are not necessarily good psychedelic sites. Okay, like I said earlier on, there's a lot of infrastructure and licensing, manufacturing, as well as the relevant people, raters, therapists, psychiatrists as well. There are a number of psychedelic sites that are extremely good. We know them. We've met them at conferences as well. And we've developed a good relationship. So for a sponsor to choose MAC, first of all, you've got to pick the right CRO. The right CRO that knows what they're doing, because we've done it. And then we can translate our learning into other sites in the US as well by doing the proper feasibility, because we know what the sponsors are looking for because we've done it. In the UK. So that makes us quite unique.
Yeah, that's fantastic. No, it's really, really helpful. And thanks for that insight. And I'm sure that we'll put that to great benefit in that respect once we're given that opportunity as a CRO.
Absolutely.
So, Shuna, as these are Schedule 1 drugs, I'd be really interested to know your experience and that of the companies with the Home Office and such like in the US.
Yeah, with regard to the Home Office, Chris, you know, the Home Office has what we call a scheduling of drugs. You know, these are controlled drugs, Schedule 1 drugs, if you know, call it that. And we have to go to the Home Office to get a license or to get agreement to hold, possess and manufacture. But then what we have to do is also then ask for another Home Office license where we can actually dose, i.e. a clinical trials Home Office license. And that's been taking quite a long time. Because we have that relationship now, our kind of response from the Home Office is very quick. You know, some people quote 16 weeks, but our metrics show it's anywhere between 6 and 10 weeks.
And now, that's just a confidence thing?
That's a confidence thing because they know us as well. And they know us in terms of, you know, what we're doing as well. And they know our investigators. They know our organization as well. We talked about new drugs, new types of, you know, analogs coming through, new types of structures coming through as well. Now, because the Home Office use a guide, the Misuse of Drugs Act, and also the Psychotropic Drugs Act, when we approach the Home Office, they say, hey, guys, this doesn't fit into the category. So therefore, we can give you a letter of no objection, which means it saves a hell of a lot of time for the sponsors. But eventually, as they update their databases, these may become Schedule 1 drugs. So there's an opportunity where we can cut massive amounts of time to start the drug with this letter of no objection. With regard to the Drug Enforcement Agency, they're slightly different. You know, they say it's a Schedule 1, that's it. They don't take that pragmatic approach as the Home Office do.
But even so, I think that relationship and past experience that we can demonstrate really does make a difference in relation to how quickly that we can
absolutely
get these sorts of studies
absolutely
moving.
And like I said, you know, a lot of the pharma, the psychedelic companies are looking at, you know, IP is very important. You know, how do you protect the IP? Because anybody can make MDMA if you know the right formulation of that. So how do you protect?
And we won't be sharing that.
We won't be sharing it. But, you know, how do you protect that? So what they do is they produce these deuterated drugs, they produce these analogs, et cetera. You know, but again, the Home Office is catching up on this type of structures, et cetera, like that. So that gives us an advantage. Who knows, later on, you know, they may classify these new kind of wave of analogs as Schedule 1 drugs. But right now, they give you a letter of no objection. But the but is, it's got to be done in a proper clinically controlled environment. They're not going to give a letter of no objection to any kind of site doing these type of programs.
So a proven track record is so important.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, the Drugs Enforcement Agency in the US takes a bit more of a sterner approach on that. Hence, you see a long delay in that. But they're turning around. But that offers an advantage.
Now, a specific question I just wanted to ask was, what is the role and the value of psychotherapy in psychedelic research? Because some companies are using different models of psychotherapy. And I just want to know, what were your own thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of answered that question earlier on, but I kind of go into it a bit deeper, okay? Psychotherapy or psychedelic-assisted therapy has a value, okay? The take-home message from the FDA is, we approve drugs, we don't approve psychotherapy. How do you uncouple that? That's going to be the key thing. You know, how do you uncouple that? That to me, is difficult. You know, you can have different models of psychotherapy. You can have an intense model, like the Lykos folks have. You can have a slimmed down model, like a dose session monitor. Or you can have something called an attendant model, where, you know, anybody can be attendant as long as they show compassion and can hold hands, etc., and things like that. So that's something, you know, people can look at as well. Psychotherapy has its place, okay? But with regards to regulatory agencies, they're trying to uncouple, you know, the role of psychotherapy, particularly with psychedelics. How do you say, actually, the MDMA works? Or is it the MDMA works because of the psychotherapy? Or, and if you look at the placebo group in the Lykos study, the placebo group that had no therapy also did very well. So that becomes challenging. And that's what people are learning the lessons from, that failure.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, without a doubt. Well, I'm sure that in future podcasts, there'll be more that you can update us on. So absolutely. I really look forward to that. But moving on, I just want to know if it would be good to hear your view in that respect on expectation bias and functional unblinding and the delivery of psychological therapy.
Yeah, that again, that great questions that require a bit more intense review on there. Can I just go? I didn't really answer your earlier question. What are other companies doing? They have not been put off by the FDA's decision. They are regrouping, relooking, etc. Yeah, it stalled, but it has not kind of warned off any other kind of companies. Cybin, Compass, Usona, all of those companies, as I mentioned, are still there. Okay, so we talked about functional unblinding. What does that mean? What is functional unblinding? Functional unblinding basically means that the active treatment that you give has a profound effect. So how do you blind that? Okay, against placebo. And
you're going to give us the answer?
Well, I can't give you the answer, but we can look at that. Yeah. And that then goes to something called a patient bias or expectancy bias. People coming to the trial thinking, I'm going to see that effect. So how do you manage those two? I mean, one way of looking at that is maybe looking at an active placebo. But then what is the right active placebo? Is it a subtherapeutic dose of the psychedelic? Or is it another class of compound that gives that hallucinogenic or psychedelic experience? But then if you look at other compounds, they don't give the same experience as you would do with the psychedelic. Okay, so that's a challenge as well. Compass did a great job where they looked at 1 milligram of psilocybin as their inverted commas placebo. That was a subtherapeutic dose. Maybe that's the way forward. Maybe, the role of psychotherapy in terms of psychotherapy should be dialed down a bit. Maybe it should be more of a model where, people come to the clinic, they're led by the hands, they're kind of explained what's going on, and these people are just observers. There's no kind of influence on that. People have to come into the clinic, they have to be told what's going on, etc. Because people are scared what they're going to do, etc., what they're going to feel. But we don't want to not bias, but we don't want to have too much of this kind of psychotherapy. We call it kind of integration before, during, and after as well.
Is that just pure and simply because of different people's expectations then?
Absolutely, different people's expectation. The other comment is, having a psychedelic experience, does that predict efficacy? That's a big question. Probably not, because companies are now developing what we call neuroplastogens or non-hallucinogenic psychedelics, i.e. don't have that psychedelic experience as well. So I'm really keen to see how that would work as well. But there are challenges. You can design the trial differently. You can use an active placebo. You can drill down, the role of the psychotherapist. You can look at different ways of crossover designs, etc., all of that. But all of that is a challenge for your everyday site. That's why it's important to go to a proper psychedelic site like us. Because, we've got the infrastructure, we've been there, and we've got the ability to do those type of...
And lots of studies behind us, as you touched on.
Well, yeah, lots of studies. I mean, I'll give you an example. We've done psilocybin, we've done IV psilocin, we've done DMT and all the deuterated analogs for that. We've also done LSD as well. We're looking at NMDA as well. We're looking at different mixtures. Ketamine, although ketamine's bunched into psychedelics, it's slightly different. But there are other psychedelics that are not tryptamine-based, like 2CB, etc. They're all kind of coming through as well. And that requires a site that understands CNS, understands the disease area, and has the infrastructure and the staff to cope with that.
No, thank you. I just want to know if you could please tell me about durability of response and safety and abuse liability.
Yeah. For example, if you were depressed, you would go to the GP and he would prescribe SSRIs once a day for 12 weeks. Okay. And they would assess either 6 or 12 weeks. Here, what we're seeing in the psychedelics, it's one dose. Is one dose enough? And the term durability came out from the psychedelic kind of research, because it is one dose. Does one dose have enough duration of efficacy? Okay, and that's another debate, is when should the second dose be done? You know, is it after 6 weeks, after 12 weeks, etc.? That's why people are hung up about durability of effect. For example, if you look at the Lykol study, it was one dose and they followed up for 12 weeks, you know, and some of them still had that duration or durability of effect as well. So that's another debate, is, you know, do we give those patients that, you know, are falling down on their HAMD scores or their MADRS another dose? Do we wait for those people that are still kind of showing efficacy to decline? We don't know. So those are another kind of challenges there as well.
Right. So,
and then,
a lot to learn, really.
There is a lot to learn. You know, safety is very important, okay? Yeah. Safety is very important. You know, these drugs work on the 5-HT2 receptor, you know, your classical tryptamine psychedelic stuff. And there are other 5-HT2 receptors dotted around, particularly around the heart or whatever. So you've got to look at the cardiovascular kind of problems as well. You've got to look at all of the safety. And then there's this abuse liability. Now, the FDA and the EMA, you know, are quite rightly saying, you know, do these drugs have a likeness? I mean, once you've used one drug, do you want to use it again? So you've got to test the abuse liability for that. I know ketamine did a study on abuse liability and they didn't show anything. And I think that's the other thing I was talking about, where Lykos didn't do the abuse liability studies properly, or they didn't do any, and the safety wasn't captured that well. So that's why companies are now thinking, okay, we've got to show the FDA or the EMEA that, you know, our drugs don't have this kind of abuse liability as well, and our drugs are safe as well, and the durability is there after one dose.
Yeah, so important. Well, no, that's given us a really good insight, and I appreciate the value of your knowledge and expertise that's been gained in relation to your involvement. So, as I say, Shuna has a vast amount of experience in the field of psychedelic research. And as a result of that, that's enabled Matt to establish himself as a real pioneer in psychedelic research and this particular field, which I think is a good position to put
us in. Thank you very much, Chris. I think we've just touched on the iceberg here. You know, there's a lot more to talk about psychedelics. I've just given you a general overview and oversight as well, you know. One thing, the reason why I joined MAC was because, you know, I come from a CNS background. It's always been CNS. You know, MAC is CNS. It's Neuroscience Center of Excellence as well. And when we're interested in a disease area, we'll put everything behind it because that's what we want to do. We are now seen, or we are seen as the psychedelic experts in the UK. And that's because it's, you know, we've been there, we've done it, we've got the T-shirt, etc., whatever. But there are great challenges ahead for psychedelics. Psychedelics has a place in mental health, and I think it's very important we should look at that. The other area we may want to explore is, what about combining the psychedelics with an SSRI? And those are the studies that we're looking at, you know. Psychedelics could also be used for Alzheimer's disease, for anorexia nervosa. People are looking at all sorts of different areas for psychedelic kind of use.
Perfect. Well, we look forward to finding out more in future podcasts.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Meanwhile, I just want to thank Dr. Shuna Vincent for his time and sharing his knowledge with us. And also just to remind everybody to be sure to subscribe to our channel to stay updated on upcoming episodes of MAC Behind the Trials. And don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn for even more insights. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.